The United States spends $2 billion a day on health care, yet 37 million Americans are uninsured.
People who are sick should not have to worry about getting poor. They should worry about getting well. We're the last or one of the last countries in the world to come to this conclusion, but it's time we gave the people of this country what they need. That's why I'm here.
The tremendous crisis of administrative costs. The General Accounting Office has estimated that $67 billion in administration could be eliminated by going to a single-payer program. This is pure paperwork. It happens in the insurance companies and also at the hospital and doctor end. But there's $67 billion that's pure waste that could just be eliminated by going to a single payer.
We look at health care in the United States. Who has it, who doesn't, what it costs, what other countries are doing, and what you can do about it. Right now on Alternative Views. Spotlighting our emphasis on health care in the United States, we have a documentary from the people who put out the series Labor at the Crossroads in New York City. But before we see our documentary, here are some news stories from the alternative press.
The movie JFK, directed by Oliver Stone, has created a national sensation and has raised some very troubling questions concerning the Kennedy assassination. The movie was attacked in all the mainstream media 6 months before it was even released, and every week practically thereafter, there was an article attacking it for its alleged distortions of the historical truth before the movie was even released, and anyone knew exactly what the movie was all about. Well, the movie opened and has created even more controversy. Newsweek attacked it in a cover story, and just about every single news media has had one critical attack on it or another. And just yesterday, the movie was violently attacked by one of the 12 lawyers who was on the legal staff of the Warren Commission that was doing research into the Kennedy assassination, calling it a gross distortion of the truth, and ranting and raving about Oliver Stone and his dishonesty, etc. Well, the good thing that came out of this is that the researchers, the 12 lawyers who were doing research for the Warren Commission, called unanimously for the government to release all documents pertaining to the Kennedy assassination to put to rest once and for all, according to this UCLA professor, the conspiracy theory that anyone more than Lee Harvey Oswald was involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Of course, Oliver Stone's movie alleged there was a vast CIA, mafia, U.S. government conspiracy to kill JFK, and in his movie he details a tremendous amount of the actual research that had been done by Gary Shaw, John Stockwell, and others who are trying to figure out who actually killed JFK. Now, you can criticize the movie JFK for, in Hollywood fashion, idealizing Jim Garrison, the star played by Kevin Costner. You can also criticize the idealization of JFK, who Oliver Stone makes out to be a total good guy, a total liberal in foreign policy, who's going to pull out of Vietnam, cut back on the national defense industry and the defense establishment, carry through a civil rights legislation and all sorts of other wonderful liberal things, whereas it's not certain that the true Kennedy was quite that wonderful a liberal. In any case, you should go see the movie for yourself because it is a blockbuster film, probably one of the best that Hollywood has put out for years.
What do you think of the campaign to rehabilitate Quayle in the media? Did you see that series in the Washington Post about where they're saying that Dan Quayle is a very experienced, highly intelligent, reliable, and brave statesman?
I saw it, but this is just more evidence of the decline of the Washington Post, because the majority of the American people have not bought into this. There's been public opinion polls that have consistently over the years given Quayle a lower and lower rating. People hold him in more and more disrespect, and more people see him as unqualified to be vice president, let alone president. And Doonberry is one of the best at getting Quayle.
Yes, and there were a score of newspapers which refused to carry Trudeau's three-week series on Dan Quayle and his relationship with dope and his dope provider back in the days of the 60s. There's this guy named Kimmerlin who's in a prison in Oklahoma who claims that he was the peddler of the goodies to Dan Quayle during Dan Quayle's earlier years. And this was just too much for some of the dailies. They just newspapers, they refused to do it. But and also they focused on many accounts focused on the fact that there was a cocaine dealer who said that he had given some dope to Quayle, but he had failed a lie detector test. But they ignored Kimmerlin. Now Kimmerlin's a guy who is in jail in Oklahoma, and they during the last election, when reporters tried to interview Kimmerlin, they locked him up in solitary confinement. As a matter of fact, he should have been up for parole as early as 1984, but they're not going to let this guy out. And the 180 months of incarceration is twice the maximum recommended in the federal guidelines, which require mandatory sentences. So they're usually unmentioned in any of the stories in the press is the fact that an assistant U.S. attorney in Indiana asked the Justice Department in 1982 to do a sting against then Senator Quayle.
What I like best about the cartoon of Gary Trudeau, the Doonesbury, is that every time Quayle appears in the comic strip, a feather represents him. Every time Bush appears, commotion, just sort of static appears, sort of nothing activity and mindless hot air. And every time David Duke appears, a swastika appears. So Gary Trudeau has these guys right where they deserve it.
The last edition of Funny Times has a one whole big page of compilation, a lot of these hilarious quotes by, what's his name?
Quayle.
Quayle, that's right. Because particularly,
Danny Boy.
Yeah, the best one, I guess, is the one where it says he was talking to people and paraphrasing the United Negro College Fund that a mind's a terrible thing to waste, and he says, "What a waste it is to lose one's mind. Or not to have a mind as being very wasteful." How true it is. That's what he said. And then another way he said, "I stand by all the misstatements I've ever made."
My favorite one is on a trip to Latin America. Actually, he was in El Salvador. He apologized that he hadn't studied Latin in high school so that he couldn't speak the language of the people there.
And he also said, "Republicans understand the importance of bondage between parent and child." And another time he said, "I believe we're on an irreversible trend toward more freedom and democracy. But that could change."
God. Actually, he's gotten in some ways a bum rap. Actually, Dan Quayle's a very talented guy. When he was a congressman and they were having debates on the floor, he wouldn't be bothering with such boring stuff. He was in his office watching two situation comedies at once, Gilligan's Island and Hogan's Heroes. And it takes quite a mind to be able to watch and follow two sitcoms at the same time. So I think Quayle's getting a bum rap from those that claim how stupid he is.
That's true. It takes a lot of insight to make a statement like this. He said, quite frankly, teachers are the only profession that teach our children. And he said, we're going to have the best educated American people in the world.
I mean, this is
and on and on.
This
and on
is absurd
on.
When American education is in tremendous crisis, when American schools aren't educating people. And, of course, the Bush administration has no plan for education because they're pretty much right-wing, and they really don't support a public school system. They basically support tax credits for private schools, for these religious schools to indoctrinate people with religious ideology, and have just allowed the public school system to fall apart. The second story I have pertaining to the Kennedy assassination comes from David Armstrong, published in the Austin Chronicle of December the 27th. Armstrong is the first to raise the questions of what is the involvement or the relationship between George Bush and the Kennedy assassination. Armstrong points out that almost everyone in the country can remember exactly what they did and what happened on that fateful day of JFK's assassination, but George Bush doesn't seem to remember what he did that day. There's a document in FBI files that indicates that George Bush called up the FBI office in Houston, Texas, and reported that a Mr. Parrott, a right-wing Republican in that city, was threatening to kill JFK, and the FBI investigated Mr. Parrott. Parrott, in an interview with Armstrong, said that FBI agents came to his house the day after the Kennedy assassination and were interviewing him, claiming that one George Herbert Walker Bush had reported that Parrott was threatening to assassinate the president, which Parrott, of course, vehemently denied. Parrott also claimed that he was a political enemy of George Bush within the Republican establishment in Houston, with Parrott representing the right wing and Bush representing the moderate wing, and they had been involved in fierce infightings. So Parrott believes that Bush was trying to smear him. The weird question is, why did George Bush, on the very day of the Kennedy assassination, the morning of it, before it even happened, call the FBI to warn them about this Parrott? It's a very weird timing. And, of course, Bush doesn't remember doing it. This is the interesting thing. When he was asked about this, he said, well, I just can't recall having done this, which is very strange since, like I indicated, everyone in the country knows what they did that day. It's just one of these days that sticks in your mind.
That's another loop that old George is out of, right?
George is out of every loop. He had nothing to do with Iran Contra. The only loop you can actually pin him on is the Gulf War, and we'll be saying a few things about that in the days to come. Now, there's two other references to George Bush and the Kennedy assassination. On November the 29th of 1963, exactly 1 week after Kennedy was gunned down, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover sent a memorandum to the State Department concerning the reaction of Miami's anti-Castro Cuban community to the tragedy. In it, Hoover reports that on the day after the assassination, Mr. George Bush of the Central Intelligence Agency was informed of the substance of the Bureau's findings concerning the response of the right-wing Cubans. Now, this is very interesting because it says CIA agency employee George Walker Bush was informed of this. Well, this raises the question whether Bush was in the CIA in the 1960s. At a time, he was the head of Zapata Oil Company and traveling through the Caribbean. And actually, he went even into the Far East, into Kuwait. In the 1960s, did George Bush go with his oil company? And the question arises whether he was doing CIA spy work then, and thus when he was named head of the CIA in 1976, he was drawn on a background of undercover work for the CIA. The CIA claims there was another George Walker Bush that was working for the agency at that time, and the other George Bush denied that he got this memo from J. Edgar Hoover, but this still has not been solved. And once again, the President Bush refuses to comment on this. Third, and also very bizarre, George Bush's name appears in the little black telephone book of a George de Morenschild, who's one of the most mysterious figures involved with the Kennedy assassination. In 1977, Morenschild told a reporter for the Wall Street Journal that the CIA had asked him to keep tabs on Oswald. And to be sure, Morenschild was a close, almost inseparable friend of Oswald's for about 6 months when he lived in Fort Worth and Dallas prior to the Kennedy assassination.
It's kind of like a father-son relationship. Morenschild was quite a bit older.
He was older, and Oswald worshipped him, looked up to him, did everything he said. There was a very close personal relation. And Morenschild later said that the CIA had assigned him to keep tabs on Oswald. Moreover, in that interview in 1977 with the Wall Street Journal, Morenschild said he was absolutely convinced that Lee Harvey Oswald was innocent, that he was a patsy, that he was set up in the Kennedy assassination, and had made arrangements to testify to that effect to the House Select Committee on Assassination that was then investigating Kennedy's death. In 1977, it briefly held some hearings on this. Well, within hours after making arrangements to testify before the committee, Morenschild was found dead, shot through the mouth. A 20-gauge shotgun was found near his body, and the coroner called the death a suicide.
Well, that's typical, like mob or CIA type execution. They shoot you through the mouth, which is supposed to represent keep your mouth shut, boy. It won't be open once we shoot you through the mouth.
And this was just one of hundreds of cases of people who were going to testify that Oswald was not the person that assassinated Kennedy, that was a vaster conspiracy involved, who was found mysteriously dead. Well, Armstrong concludes that there's no evidence that George Bush was involved in a conspiracy to kill Kennedy. Nevertheless, many questions remain about Bush's activities during this period. Specifically, where was George Bush on November the 22nd, 1963, and what did he do that day? Did he call the FBI to report an alleged threat against Kennedy's death? Was he briefed by the FBI about anti-Castro Cuban activities following the Kennedy assassination? And why did George Bush's name appear in the address book of George de Morenschild? What was his relationship with this shadowy figure? These are very serious matters, Armstrong argues, that deserve clear and unambiguous answers. More troubling, he says, is that Bush just simply refuses to comment on these questions. And the press, I would say, has never raised these questions with Bush. For some reason, Bush is off the hook. He's never asked probing questions about his relations with Noriega, his relationships with Iran-Contra, his connections with the CIA. None of Bush's highly questionable past seems to be interested for the mass media that's more interested in Bill Clinton's sexual affairs than the history and background of the current president.
We'll have more news later in the program, but now let's see our Labor at the Crossroads documentary called No More Band-Aids.
Labor at the Crossroads is a show about us, working people. 1992 is our fourth season working to put our issues on television. Labor X is made by students and educators at Hunter College in New York City with help from the labor community.
I can't afford it. It's too expensive.
And do you worry a lot about what would happen if somebody were to get sick when you don't have insurance?
Definitely do worry about it. It's a big problem for me because right now, with the economy being not so good, it's like just have to wait. I hope we stay healthy. That's the only thing I can say.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Anna.
I'm a Medicare patient. I can get Medicare, and I have a Medicare supplement. But I'm fortunate enough to be able to pay for it. There's lots of people that can't.
Right, and if you didn't have the supplement, what would the quality of the care be like, in your opinion?
Well, it would be a great deal poorer than it is today. There's no doubt of that.
The premium was at almost $600 because I'm just one person. If it was a family, it'd be different, but then I don't really have like children of my own, so... But they can't take advantage of it.
Did you worry about what would happen if you got sick?
Yeah, I do. I mean, right now I need not surgery, but I need to go like doctors and stuff, and I just don't have the money to cover like a specialist, so I'm forced to go to city hospital.
At least I'm lucky to have a job, but yet still the company talk about, like, we're going through negotiations right now. You know, they talking about cutting back on certain things, you know. How you gonna cut back? You ain't giving us nothing now. We only thing we got now is crumbs. You gonna take a little bit of crumbs we got now and give us nothing? Oh man, that's not gonna work.
What's wrong with this country and its health care?
February 7, 1992, disabled Brooklyn residents and their home care attendants protest a proposed $1 billion in state Medicaid cuts. The crisis in health care is not limited to Medicaid recipients, poor people, or to New York State. The United States spends $2 billion a day on health care, yet 37 million Americans are uninsured.
We are here this morning to declare an emergency. An emergency for the 37 million Americans with no health insurance. An emergency for the children dying at third world rates. An emergency for the working people afraid to go to a doctor because they cannot pay out-of-pocket costs.
It is indeed a sign of genuine crisis in our health care system that even our employed citizens cannot afford insurance coverage or Medicaid costs. This problem is not confined to New York City or even the cities in general, but reaches across our entire nation.
What would you like to see for health care? No cuts!
national health care for everybody.
The New York Jobs with Justice health care campaign is a coalition of New York unions that supports single-payer national health insurance, which primarily means H.R. 1300, the Russo bill in Congress.
And the single-payer concept is essentially that all money will go into one pot and then will be paid out to the various health providers, whether they're individuals or HMOs or other healthcare organizations, hospitals.
A single payer essentially means that there is a single insurance fund that's a public fund, a little like Social Security. People pay into it, individuals and employers, corporations, pay on a basis of fair taxes into a fund that is then the sole payer of doctors and providers of health care.
The advantage of the single-payer plan is that it will establish one class of medical care, and everyone will pay the same for their services, and so there won't be a second class of citizens that have lesser reimbursement rates and may, for that reason, get less access to care or be given other drugs.
Healthcare depends on the healthcare you need and not the healthcare you can afford. That is the goal. That is the principle. Prenatal care and children's health are based on what they need or not what their parents can afford to give them.
Those of us who have children, those of us who are older, again being made to choose between kids and taking care of aged parents, no one should be put in that position. It's a humiliation.
People who are sick should not have to worry about getting poor. They should worry about getting well. We're the last, or one of the last countries in the world to come to this conclusion, but it's time we gave the people of this country what they need. That's why I'm here.
We see a direct relationship between the crisis of high costs and the crisis of lack of access. You can't address one without addressing the other.
Patients sometimes will hesitate to go to the doctor because of the costs involved. I've had several patients who've postponed or canceled clinic visits because they've lost their job or for other reasons have had economic problems. Another issue is medications. I really dislike having to ask someone what kind of insurance they have before I write a prescription for them. And some medications are more expensive than others, and sometimes if you give someone an expensive medication and they don't have insurance, they can't afford it and they won't fill the prescription.
When you go to see a doctor or a hospital, they wouldn't ask to see what your insurance plan is to find out how much you can pay, because everyone would pay the exact same thing, whoever you are, so that the healthcare industry would not look at people in terms of how much they could pay. They'd look at them in terms of their health.
One of the models that has been presented for a national health program in the U.S. is the Canadian model. And one of the main criticisms that we hear leveled against that is that it's rationing of health care. And there was an editorial in the Times last week that mentioned that 15 people in British Columbia died in 1990 waiting for heart surgery. Well, if you think about it, in this country there's some inequities in health care, which some would call rationing, that are much worse than that. And a study was done on excess mortality in Harlem that showed that in Harlem, which is much, much smaller population than British Columbia, in 1 year, 348 people died of heart disease when only 152 would have been expected. So 196 patients died of heart disease that shouldn't have died of heart disease. That was due in part to social conditions, but also in part to lack of access to elective heart surgery and other medical procedures and lack of access to primary care. And you could look at that as a form of rationing based on the individual's economic and insurance status, which is much, much worse than the kind of rationing that we see in the industrialized countries that have national health programs. So which type of rationing, which inequity is worse, is a question that I think we should look at.
It would cover the sick as well as the healthy. the unemployed as well as those with jobs with benefit plans. It would cover the old as well as the young. It would also eliminate all of the red tape and the bureaucracy we now have, and it would save billions and billions of dollars. The crisis is obvious, but the solution is as obvious as well.
There are powerful interests arrayed against us. There are a lot of insurance companies that want to stop this legislation from moving in the state and in Washington, and they have money. You know they have lots of money. They get it from you. What we have going for us is the simple truth. The American healthcare system is a broken-down gas guzzler. It doesn't work, and it costs too much.
They have heard from the Mutual of Omaha Insurance Company, and they have heard from medical equipment companies and suppliers of and device manufacturers. They have heard from the hospital associations and the Hartford Insurance Company. They have heard from Blue Cross and Blue Shield. They have heard from pharmaceutical companies, and they have heard from over 1,400 other insurance companies. Today, and every day hereafter, they will hear from us.
We're particularly concerned with the billions and billions of dollars that we're throwing away on administrative costs and insurance industry profits and everything but actually providing health care.
There's a tremendous crisis of administrative costs. The General Accounting Office has estimated that $67 billion in administration could be eliminated by going to a single-payer program. This is pure paperwork. It happens in the insurance companies and also at the hospital and doctor end. But there's $67 billion that's pure waste that could just be eliminated by going to a single-payer.
There are about 1,500 insurance companies, each of which has their own form that the doctor has to fill out or the hospital and send in, and it's extremely chaotic. Billions of dollars are spent every year, literally wasted, dealing with the difficult, almost impossible morass of different insurance companies and different systems. And it would be good not to have to spend time thinking about what is the best diagnosis to write that will maximize the reimbursement from the insurance company, which is done all the time in many hospitals. They even have people who are full-time employees to think about how to maximize reimbursement. So it would take that whole burden off of both the physician and hospital system.
I trusted you when you said cutting taxes for the rich would trickle down to people like me. I was skeptical, but I trusted you. Now the rich are much richer and the poor are much poorer. And you want me to vote for you while you do it again? Read my lips.
Of the many health care options on the table, only national health insurance would guarantee equal access to quality health care for all Americans. Similar to the Canadian system, it would stop healthcare dollars from going to unnecessary medical procedures, insurance company profits, and administrative waste.
The Bush plan is one of the more bizarre offerings because it's essentially a pure giveaway to the insurance industry. Bush has literally proposed that through the IRS we give $100 billion to the insurance industry and subsidized premiums. It's the biggest, it's not tax and spend, but it comes to the same thing. It's an incredible giveaway to the industry that's causing this crisis. And I think that the business community has already revolted against it, and I don't think we have to take it too seriously because it was just an effort to get something out there. The bigger threat that we see is the pay-or-play approach, which it intends to fill the gaps. Essentially what the people advocating pay or play say is that we don't have the political strength to take on the insurance industry or to take on the for-profit medical establishment. Therefore, we should work with what we've got, try to fix up the status quo, fill in the gaps, insure the uninsured, try to do some cost containment. It's a way of trying to salvage the status quo. We believe it won't work. In the first place, we don't think it'll pass because even pay or play steps on a lot of toes. If we're going to get the political clout to solve the crisis, then we have to solve the crisis.
We do see patients that have spent several days in the emergency room waiting for admission, sometimes on respirators even, requiring intensive care unit level of care. It's not a good place to get that level of care because, as you know, emergency rooms are very busy and the doctors should be spending their time seeing many patients and making triage decisions rather than providing ICU care to individual patients. Increasing the accessibility of primary care services would take the burden off the emergency rooms both numerically and in terms of the kind of care that they provide. Patients wouldn't show up with a sore throat at 2 o'clock in the morning and have to be seen when that doctor or physician assistant or nurse could be seeing someone who really has an emergency.
We're solving every problem with expensive high-tech solutions instead of looking at getting preventive and less expensive solutions to people. In Canada, more than half of doctors are primary physicians. In the U.S., I think it's something like 13%. We've just been putting too much money into highly specialized, very highly paid physicians. Primary care physicians in Canada make about what their counterparts make in the U.S. It's the specialists in the U.S. who are making so much more.
More important than the cost-effectiveness argument is the human argument that if you can prevent someone from getting sick, you prevent their suffering, you may prevent their death, and that is clearly something worth doing.
A buddy of mine busted his ankle playing ball the other day. Spent a week in the hospital, cost him $10,000. Didn't have any insurance, neither do I. If I break my leg, they're going to have to shoot me. Tell me again, what's wrong with national health insurance?
Many of you out there already feel complacent because you have some health insurance. I'm here to tell you, you better not feel so smug. You're at risk. Everybody's at risk. If you or anybody in your family has a chronic medical condition, you are at risk. If you work for yourself or have a small business or are individually covered, you are at risk. Your insurance company makes you pay too much for checkups, or when you get sick, you are at risk. Your insurance company continually raises your premiums, you're at risk. Your insurance company puts a lifetime limit on how much they will pay if you get sick, you are at risk. If your insurance company can deny you or does not cover the treatment your doctor prescribes, you are at risk. You have no guarantee that you will have insurance when you need it most. You are in trouble.
Nationalize health care. Make it better for everyone because everybody's suffering right now. And it's very hard for people nowadays to keep up with the cost of living, as we all know.
You advocate national health care.
Right.
Okay.
Everybody should have it, no matter what the person's about, he could have it. Same as England is trying to do. No matter what the person's about, no matter what his status is, he gets health care. And they have that, and they have a problem in the economy. They're a big country. Why can't we do it?
I think it's outrageous.
that this country and South Africa are the only two industrialized nations that don't have a national health service. We look at Canada, and they're doing marvelously well, and then our president comes out with some asinine suggestions. And where is he going to take the money from Medicare and Medicaid to pay for this cockabolly plan he has? Why doesn't he ask the Canadians how they're doing it, or some of the other countries? They're doing fine. Why aren't we?
In October of 1991, ambulances drove across the United States to dramatize the need for a health care solution. Stopping in cities across the country, they collected health care ballots to be delivered to Washington. In New York City, thousands of working people, union members, politicians, and health care providers showed their support for H.R. 1300, the Rousseau bill in Congress.
What we're trying to do is try to get ballots to Washington to let them know that we want national health care for everyone in the United States. That's what this rally is about.
What do you have to do?
Well, we're asking people to sign their names and to vote. And these things, these ballots are going in an ambulance. See that ambulance over there? They're going to drive to Washington and deliver the ballots.
So what you're looking for is a healthy America.
A healthy America, right. You want to sign up?
Hi.
When they ask us where we're going to get the money to pay for the programs we want, tell them we're going to get it by ending this obscene waste of money on a grossly inefficient healthcare system. With an extra $75 billion a year, we could triple the output of affordable housing in this country, spend 10 times what we now spend on job training, and have $5 billion left over to put into literacy programs and Head Start. So when people ask you, where's the money for the social programs, tell them it's in H.R. 1300. If we pass that now, we will be healthier and richer.
If you put a referendum to the American people today and ask them about national health care, we would have a comprehensive health care bill. The American people are way ahead of their congressional leaders on this issue, and we have to give them the courage to go vote for H.R. 1300, the Rousseau bill. We have to reach every single member of Congress and tell them to sign on to that bill, because the American people are ready for it. It's just the Congress and certainly the White House that's obstructionist on this issue.
We have to make democracy work. Everybody is affected. Everybody is united across classes, all races, religions. Across America, the polls show that the people want it. The focus groups show that the people want it. And that Washington seems to be paralyzed. We have to make the will of the people operate in Washington.
A lot of people think that it doesn't make any difference if you write a letter or a postcard or pick up the phone and call a member of Congress. But it really does. They sit there and they count how many people called or wrote about health care that week. That's what we have to do. We have to write them and flood them with letters. We have elections coming up. We have to ask every elected official, what is your position on this issue? Do you want to put a Band-Aid on the gouge, or do you want a real answer to health care reform?
Thank you.
You're watching Alternative Views. Well, we have some time for some more news stories from the Alternative Press.
Here's a good story which comes from the southern Indian state of Kerala. I'd never heard of it before, but the Adni Reader for November-December 1991 has found four different publications which give the story about Kerala. If it were a separate country, it would be ninth on the list of the world's poorest countries. But in the terms of standard of life, it's an astonishing success story. There are 29 million people in Kerala. They all have access to health care, to education, and a life expectancy that approaches that of Americans. But it's a very poor place. Well, how can they do it? Kerala's gross national product averaged only $182 in 1986, compared to over $17,000 for the United States. But they have chosen economic redistribution over economic growth, and they've chosen radical political reforms over taking loans from Western banks and being subjected to the rapacious nature of the International Monetary Fund. How have they done this? Well, the peasants are very highly organized, and the workers have too, and they've struggled for land reform, distribution of wealth, health care, education, clean water, through popular protest and through electing left and left-leaning governments, to use a establishment term, left-leaning. In 1969, for instance, 1.5 million tenant farmers and laborers won the title to the land that they had been working on. It took some protest and pressure on the government, but it occurred. And then Monthly Review, that was In Context, a publication called In Context, and then Monthly Review for January of 1991 reported that in the 1970s, the peasants, unions, and activists agitated for clean water and electricity in most of the villages, and also the construction of a lot of houses. They got 57,000 new houses. And then for education, Kerala became the first Indian literate state. Interpress Service reported in mid-1991 that they now have a 93% literacy rate, and it's also the only Indian state where women are as literate as men. Now, the people have, as I said, are radical and militant, and they've consistently kept information about what's going on in the government passing around among all the people, and this has helped to keep Kerala's administration relatively free from corruption that plagues other states. So this is a very good model for how underdeveloped countries can provide good living conditions for their people, not going the Western route, but through redistribution of economic and political resources.
On January the 6th, the New York Times published in their op-ed section an expose of one of the biggest propaganda frauds of the Gulf War. The publisher of Harper's Magazine published an expose of the allegations that the Iraqis had killed 132 Kuwaiti babies that were in baby incubators in a hospital in Kuwait when they invaded that country. According to a story that was spread by Amnesty International, that was frequently on the media in the United States, the Iraqis pulled these baby incubators out of a hospital in Kuwait and left the babies to die on the floor. This was exposed as a fraud after the war, when ABC and CNN and some of the other television networks went into the hospital where this atrocity allegedly took place and found that the incubators were still there. There weren't that many incubators in the first place in the hospital, and the doctors that worked there said such an event had never happened. Well, the way the story spread was that in November of 1990, there was testimony to Congress and to the United Nations from eyewitnesses in Kuwait that saw, allegedly, these atrocities occur. One was a 15-year-old girl who testified to Congress that she saw with her own eyes these babies dying on the floor because of the Iraqi atrocities. Well, it turned out that this 15-year-old girl was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the U.S., a member of the al-Sabah family that was almost daily during the Gulf War on television. And he had coerced his 15-year-old daughter to testify, to lie about this atrocity, and she pulled it off brilliantly. She should have gotten an Academy Award, because both 2020 and 60 Minutes actually showed the film of her testimony and also involved themselves in the expose of this fraud. There was also testimony from a Kuwaiti doctor who also alleged that he had seen 40 babies killed and helped bury them because of the Iraqi atrocity. And it turned out this so-called doctor was a dentist that never worked in this hospital where the atrocities took place. And later he claimed that he did not actually experience this, that he'd heard it secondhand, thus trying to distance himself from this propaganda story. Well, this is a classical propaganda campaign to try to demonize your enemy. In fact, it was concocted by the Hill and Knowlton public relations campaign that was hired by the Kuwaiti government to try to turn American public opinion against the Iraqis. And basically, they had two pillars in these campaigns. One, the Kuwait raped, and two, the Iraqi atrocity cards. The metaphor of rape is, of course, a horrible one, and that's the one that was used by this public relations firm, and it was picked up by the Bush administration, by Schwarzkopf, and by the media. So this metaphor of rape was a standard one, as were these Iraqi atrocity stories, many of which were manufactured. This goes all the way back to World War I, where there were all these allegations about German soldiers raping Allied women, about the Germans killing Belgian babies, etc. And the same emotional propaganda campaign was carried out by the Kuwaitis with the aid of their public relations firm, Hill and Knowlton, in coordination with the Bush administration and the Pentagon, because one of the Hill and Knowlton executives that was involved with this campaign was none other than Craig Fuller, George Bush's former chief of staff and a close friend of Bush, a Bush loyalist, who was helping Bush sell his campaign by helping the Kuwaitis do their public relations campaign. So here we have a concerted campaign between a U.S. public relations firm, between the United States and the Kuwaiti government, to demonize the Iraqis. And Bush, six times during the month of December, mentioned this Kuwaiti baby atrocity in his speeches. Dan Quayle repeatedly referred to this. All of the Pentagon briefers referred to this as how evil and demonic the Iraqis were. And it was nothing but public relations to turn the American people against the Iraqis, because on the eve of the Gulf War, and particularly during November and December, the overwhelming majority of the American people were against Bush carrying out a war in the Gulf to drive the Iraqis out of Kuwait. So to get public support, they cooked up all of these atrocity stories, and it worked tremendously because the media bought them hook, line, and sinker, and the American public bought these stories. So this is absolutely classic propaganda campaign.
Oh, yes, we do have a free press in this country. Who was it who said that, there's a free press for all those people who own one? Then you go to take classes at the university, the journalism schools, and they say, well, now the universities, they do an objective job. They're the guardians of the people, and they're the watchdogs over government. And no, the owners and the publishers don't get in and muck around and censor or distort the news. Well, we know better, don't we? And it's happened again. Investigating series on Los Alamos National Laboratory by the Santa Fe New Mexican resulted in the sacking of the daily newspaper's managing editor. There was a probe of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, a three-month probe, matter of fact, and 30 articles over six days came out of it. And they described the contamination of the community and the increased leukemia risk. And then there were follow-up articles as well. However, the boys who were doing the story, maybe they forgot who their owner was. Robert McKinney lives in Virginia, and he's long been involved in promoting nuclear technology, not only on his own, but also he represented the United States at the International Atomic Energy Commission, and he thinks, oh my goodness, atomic energy is just wonderful. He's meddled in news before. A story on affordable housing problems was killed by out-of-town McKinney, who allegedly told the managing editor, whom he subsequently fired, that there weren't any such problems in Santa Fe. It was just, quote, people trying to live beyond their means. Hey, we got a great quote in this regard. Former director of Los Alamos Laboratories was given a whole bunch of extra time and space in the newspaper by the publisher to do rebuttals. And here's one of the things he said. As far as nuclear contamination is concerned, any activity creates waste. Making a dinner salad, baking a pie, burning coal, cleaning bedpans in a hospital, and handling nuclear materials, it's all waste. Nuclear wastes are no more dangerous than any other wastes. This is a former director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory. Now, maybe his wastes are as dangerous as nuclear waste, but wow. New Mexican newspaper reporters have been forbidden to cover stories about nuclear industry in the past. Los Alamos and the waste isolation pilot plant near Carlsbad were proposed in hotly controversial nuclear waste depository stories. They were all killed. And the Washington Post found out about it, and they said that 6 months after the series ran, an internal Los Alamos report criticized its own safety record and essentially confirmed much of what had been in the paper's February series that got the poor managing editor fired. Publisher McKinney has ordered that the series not be nominated for any journalism prizes. And that's the end of this Alternative Views. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. We would like to thank our crew for our production, Eric Eubank, Kevin L. West, and Brian Lynch. We also are appreciative of the organization in New York City who puts out the Labor at the Crossroads series, for letting us use their documentary, No More Band-Aids. Their number is 212-772-4129. And our address is the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. Goodbye.